You're listening to Turning Hard Times into Good Times with your host, Jay Taylor. If you have a question or comment about today's show, Jay would love to hear from you at 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also send an email to questionsfortaylor@gmail.com. That's questions, the number 4, taylor@gmail.com. Now, back to our program.
Welcome back to Turning Hard Times into Good Times. I am your host, Jay Taylor, and I'm really pleased to have with me a really good friend, John Rubino. John's been on the show many times before. His website is dollarcollapse.com. I urge you to go there because there's countless numbers of very important and interesting articles to read there. We'll probably touch on a couple of them in our discussion in the next few minutes. But thanks for joining me again, John.
Oh, sure, Jay. Great to be back.
Always good to have you with me. The propaganda that's put out by the Fed has been that interest rates will be rising because the Fed policies have been good for the economy, and finally the economy is back on the mend. I don't buy that one, but nonetheless, that's what we're being told. So rates will rise for a good reason. They'll be rising because the economy is strong. The shortage of money out there, people have to bid for the money and to borrow all the money because they're going to borrow and they're going to want to borrow because everything is so good in the economy. But you put out an article recently titled "Maybe the Recovery Wasn't Real After All." So, John, if we take off our rose-colored glasses that are compliments of the Federal Reserve, what is your view of the economy now? How much on the mend are we?
Well, during 2016 and early 2017, we did get a lot of good top-line numbers. But I think a lot of that is attributed to the fact that we borrowed a huge amount of money in 2016. When there's a presidential election, generally what happens is the federal government steps up its spending, usually by borrowing more money and then spending it, in order to get its people reelected or elected. And in this case, the Obama administration went all out to get Hillary elected, borrowed a ton of money, and spent it. And so we got a little pop in growth there. But overall, the economy just hasn't been that strong throughout this entire recovery. And now it seems to be starting to roll over. Manufacturing numbers just came out that were very weak. Housing starts are weak. Home sales are weak. And on and on. Consumer spending, retail sales. So it does kind of look like we're going back to the situation that we were in at the beginning of 2016, where the numbers really don't justify rising interest rates, at least don't justify the Fed initiating higher interest rates at the short end of the yield curve. Mm-hmm. I don't know, because we've taken on so much debt over the last 30 years and especially over the last 10 years, and excessive debt is deflationary. It's very hard to grow when you already owe too much money, whether you're an individual or a country. And that's our situation. So the governments of the world are leaning against this with extremely easy money, lots of currency creation, extremely high government spending, of which China is a really interesting example. Their government spending went up by 25% in the last year. and their credit creation is running at record levels right now. So you're seeing the governments of the world attempt to generate organic growth. In other words, to prime the pump to the point where the economy grows at a rate that doesn't require excessive government borrowing and spending. And so far, it doesn't seem to be working. Mm-hmm. it looked like in 2016 that it might have been working, but really all that was just a ton of new borrowing and spending. And so if it doesn't work, that creates some really interesting problems for the world's governments and central banks, which I guess we can go on to talk about here if you want.
Yeah, for sure. Well, before we get to that, though, I'm just looking at one of your articles that you put out, the one I just referred to, Maybe the Recovery Wasn't Real After All. And folks, you can go to dollarcollapse.com to read about this article and many others that are there. But, the Atlanta Fed, John, has been out in front and been so right about their predictions about the growth of the economy, at least over the last year or so. And they are really looking at a sub 1% growth right now, right?
Yeah. Well, in the article that I posted a couple of weeks back, they were looking at like 0.9% growth.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And now that's down to about 0.5%. So it's slowed down in the meantime. Yeah, every new piece of data that comes in causes the Atlanta Fed to assume that the first quarter was even weaker than they thought it was. And, you know, remember, their estimate for first quarter growth was almost 3.5% as recently as February. And since that time, it has just cratered. It's fallen off the table. So, and the other economists out there who usually trail the Atlanta Fed in the, you know, the decrease in GDP estimates, they're heading down that way too. So everybody is starting to assume that first quarter GDP was much, much weaker than they thought it was going to be as recently as a few months ago. So the question then becomes, is this a trend? You know, is this going to continue going forward, or was it just a little downward blip in an otherwise healthily growing system? And again, you know, all the debt that's out there is so deflationary and such a hindrance to growth that it's completely possible that first quarter growth, being as weak as it is actually going to set the tone for the rest of the year. We'll have to wait and see, but it's totally looking like that based on a lot of the other numbers coming out. You know, if manufacturing is weak, home building is rolling over, and retail sales are down, then where do you get growth? And it's not clear where it comes from at this point.
Yeah, I heard the auto industry's in some trouble as well, in many ways. So, well, John, I have to wonder, you know, then what does this mean for the yield curve? If, you know, if the Fed on the one hand is trying to talk the economy up, trying to make everybody believe that growth is strong, and yet it just isn't, or it doesn't look like it is for sure, and it looks like it, as you suggest, that we could be in a downward trend here. What are they to do? They can't really go out and say, well, we're just going to run the printing presses and we're going to generate growth that way, because if they did that, you know, it would lose confidence. People would lose confidence in the system, right? They have to believe that the economy is strong, or else people will start to doubt the policymakers and their credibility.
Well, yeah. You know, a fiat currency system runs on the confidence of the people buying and selling stuff in the ability of the government to run the economy correctly. And if the government fails to do that, then people pull in their horns, financially speaking, and the system falls apart, because there are vastly more claims on resources out there than there are resources to cover those claims in a fractional reserve banking system. So the system can collapse very easily. And that's the thing that these guys are worried about now, because if it becomes clear that the government is out of tools, you know, that they've got nothing left to throw at this thing, and the economy is slowing down despite the fact that they've already, you know, fired all their weapons in the last few years, then the markets are liable to behave accordingly, which is to say that, you know, risk on, in other words, people buying stocks and bonds and real estate, becomes risk off. People going to cash and precious metals and other hard assets that governments can't inflate away. And the system, from a Keynesian standpoint, grinds to a halt then. And then all this debt starts to blow up and you get a 1930s style depression. That's what these guys are worried about. And they're right to worry. With the amount of debt that we've taken on over the past 30 years, some kind of a deflationary collapse is completely possible. You know, we owe way more now than we owed in 1929, which was the last time everything fell apart. Yeah. And we owe orders of magnitude more than we owed in 1929, if you count all the stuff now that's not called debt as debt, you know, unfunded liabilities and the pension stuff that we've got going on and derivatives. All of these things are obligations that requires somebody to pay something, which is the definition of debt. And if you add all that up, we owe three or four times more now than we owed. Yeah, in relation to the size of the economy.
So in the depression.
We're grossly over-leveraged and extremely fragile because of that.
So, John, speaking of the debt, another article that you wrote that people can read at dollarcollapse.com, soaring global debt sets stage for unprecedented private deleveraging. As you're saying, debt is deflationary. It's deleveraging. It means the system has to go in reverse. And I'd like to just read here a bit of a quote from that article. You said, pointing to an explosive debt situation, you stated, and I quote, "These numbers are astounding. Emerging market debt was $7.4 trillion in 1996, and today it's $55 trillion. U.S. and U.K. government debt has doubled from already historically high levels since 2006. You were just talking about off-balance sheet stuff in addition to that, of course, that you were just saying. You went on to say in your article, and there is no end in sight, Japan just passed a record-high government budget, 35% of which will be borrowed. The U.S. added $1.3 trillion to its federal debt in 2016 and is debating massive increases in defense and infrastructure spending now. China's corporate debt alone, which you talked about a little bit ago, exceeds 170% of GDP, which leads to three inescapable conclusions. One, interest rates can never rise because rolling over this much debt at historically normal rates would blow up the budgets of both the developed and developing worlds. Two, the only situation, if you can call it that, is massive currency devaluation to make these debts manageable. Three, since the debt binge has apparently gone parabolic, the reckoning is fairly close at hand. 2018 might be one for the history books, end of quote. So, John, you're saying interest rates can never rise because rolling over this much debt, historical low rates, will blow things up. But what you're saying is that statement suggests then that the policymakers have control of interest rates, right?
Yeah. Well, they have historically had control of interest rates, and they hope they do going forward. And they're terrified that they might not. And that's a legitimate fear because the markets can just spin out of control at this point. You know, what will probably happen going forward, because we've already learned the lesson that austerity does not work in a highly leveraged system. Because if you try to scale back government spending and hope the private sector takes over for you if you're an over-indebted government, what you get is Greece. You know, the private sector will just collapse under the weight of all its debts if you're not continually feeding it with new credit.
Right.
So the governments of the world seem to have come to that conclusion, that they have no choice but just to ramp it up, you know, to create new currency and borrow new money and spend it all and just hope for the best going forward, which is a prescription for an out-of-control credit bubble, which, you know, I think by a lot of standards we've got right now. If negative interest rates on government debt isn't a sign of a credit bubble, then not much else is. But you've got a lot of others too. You know, stocks are at record levels. You're seeing real estate prices just go crazy in a lot of parts of the world. You know, Canada, yeah. Toronto, Canada saw its housing prices jump by almost 25% year over year in the last 12 months. That's crazy. Wow. You know, that's completely unsustainable. But that's because the money that they're creating out there, the governments of the world, it has to go somewhere. So it goes into, you know, the hottest asset classes. And eventually it blows up those hot asset classes. So what we're seeing around the world is the early stages of something like a credit bubble bursting. You know, China had two big companies just really collapse in the last month. You know, their biggest dairy company, which they're defining as too big to fail and looking at bailing it out. Mm-hmm. And then the world's biggest aluminum producer. They both financially blew up in just the last month or so. And that's the kind of thing that happens at the peak of credit bubbles, when you get big companies starting to blow up and then governments having to bail them out with newly created currency, which makes the situation even worse, and until it just all falls apart. So there's no way to know when the it all falls apart day happens. But it certainly feels like we're in that territory, you know, in a place where some external shock could send the system over a cliff. And, you know, Jay, we've got a lot of potential external shocks out there now on the political world. And
its situation. Goodness. Oh, do we ever? Well, yeah. John, you know, you mentioned a bit ago that the fiat currencies are a confidence game. They're a con game, if you will. And which leads me to my next question. I passed this on to you because I wanted your comments on it. Who is funding the treasuries? You know, if at these low rates, who wants to own the darn things? Who wants to? Why would you want to own them when they're negative real rates of interest they're paying you? And we have over the last 2 years, 2015, 2016, we've seen the Chinese, well, not only the Chinese, net reduction of treasury holdings by 12% or something like that. the Social Security Trust Fund is still buying treasuries, but a lot less because there's fewer people paying in now. The labor market isn't all that good. And there's a lot of us old guys that are starting to pull it out. And so they don't have as much to buy treasuries with. And we know the quantitative easing fell away, supposedly. And so the author of this letter, his name is Chris Hamilton. This piece that actually people can, there's a link to it from miningstocks.com if they want to go and read his article titled, If the Fed Sells Treasuries, Who Will Be Buying? Answer, Other. Seriously, Other. Well, so the Fed is suggesting that, in fact, I was looking at the numbers, more than ever before, domestic buyers are buying U.S. treasuries. Because these other sources are buying, and by that they're not including the Social Security Trust Fund, but there's this domestic buyers more than ever since the beginning of our country. What the Treasury calls domestic buyers, but they don't explain who those domestic buyers are. There's about half of the domestic purchases of treasuries that they label as other, and I mean it's like 700 in the last 2 years, $745 billion worth in 2015-2016. The next largest is mutual funds with $497 billion. Then you have some smaller ones like banks, $137 billion. You've got private investors, whatever that is, insurance a little bit, state and local $5 billion. I mean, it's nothing. And so, John, I'm wondering who these other buyers could be. I mean, it's a huge chunk of treasury buying, and why wouldn't they want us to know who the other is?
Well, they don't want us to know a lot of things, Jay. And here's what's going to happen. A couple of decades from now, historians are finally going to get their hands on the actual documentation for all this stuff. And they're going to bring in forensic accountants to dig into this stuff. And the stuff they're going to find will be just hair-raising, you know, about the lies that are being told right now. And in the meantime, you and I right now, and the other people who actually care about this stuff, which is, I'm afraid, just a handful of people in the world, but we're kind of stuck with incomplete information. We can't know this because they're hiding it on balance sheets that aren't completely explained. And the Belgium thing of a couple of years ago, when Belgium was buying, you know, more than their GDP worth of treasury
bonds, right.
they were
right.
just a conduit for China at the time. Mm-hmm. This time around, obviously, this other category is going to turn out to be just some intermediary that's buying huge amounts of treasury bonds for some big central bank, probably, that is creating currency out of thin air in order to buy these bonds, which means that the whole bond thing is just an illusion, because what we've got now is governments spending whatever they feel like, and then financing themselves by creating a lot of new currency. And, you know, issuing bonds and then buying the bonds back is just this little kind of shell game that goes on in the middle to hide the fact that governments are financing themselves with newly printed currency, which is historically the final stage in the destruction of a monetary system, right? When you start right. self-financing with newly created currency, monetizing your government, in other words, that usually precedes a currency collapse. So that's where we are, you know.
All right, and a currency collapse, John, we're just about out of time, but that one that purchase of currency is really what's leading us nuts. I mean, this is your conclusion, was they have to debase the currency. We're going to see currency values declining dramatically, much more than they have already, and they've already declined dramatically. So I guess gold and silver is the most logical place to go to, other tangibles that you have to have. I want to thank you very much, John, for helping us understand this. And I want to tell people to go to dollarcollapse.com. Here's one you got to read, and I haven't read it entirely yet, but I just saw the headlines, and I've got to get a hold of this one. Don't hide your gold coins where your thermostat can see. John, you wrote that. 30 seconds. Comment on that?
Well, yeah. Technology is making it possible for other people to spy on us everywhere. You know, smart houses involve lots of sensors and things like that that can watch us and tell what we're doing. TV sets and increasingly refrigerators and washing machines and stuff like that. So if you're going to be hiding precious metals at home, you now need to be very careful about your smart house, paying attention to what you're doing. If somebody's sending a signal out into the world, that involves where you're hiding these gold coins you just bought, you're not safe anymore. So you got to be extra careful about the where you store it part of the precious metals equation.
Okay, thank you, John, very much. We are out of time. Thank you for that. Dollarcollapse.com. Folks, go there, read John's articles. They're really fascinating and important. That's all the time we have this week. Next week, Peter Granich will be my guest. Until then, goodbye and God's blessings to you.
Thank you again for listening to Turning Hard Times into Good Times with Jay Taylor. Please join us again next Tuesday at noon Pacific Time, 3 p.m. Eastern Time on the Voice America Business Channel.
Dynacert is a global leader in carbon emission reduction technologies. Created for use in diesel engines, the hydrogen unit has been proven to reduce carbon emissions by up to 40%, increase torque, improve engine oil quality, and provide up to 19% in fuel savings. Our leading-edge technology is designed for tractor trailers, rail, marine, and newly developed for diesel engine cars. Reducing the amount of greenhouse gases provides benefits to the environment, to communities and businesses, and to our shareholders. Chilean Metals is a Canadian junior exploration company focusing on high potential copper, gold prospects in Chile and Canada. Chilean Metals' Zulima property is a Candelaria-like prospect, one of the largest mines in the world. The company has begun its drill program in Chile on its Zulima property and should be completed by the end of February. We also own a 3% royalty on future production on Teck Resources' Copaquiri property, potentially worth millions of dollars annually. This is the time to invest in Chilean Metals, a discovery story with a hedge. Traded TSX Venture under symbol CMX.
Arvista Gold's only asset is the Douay Gold Project, which is located in northern Quebec. The Douay Project currently hosts an NI 43101 resource of approximately 3 million ounces of gold and is considered to be the largest undeveloped and independent gold project in Quebec. Arvista has significant upside potential to further grow its resources and is currently undergoing an extensive 2017 drill campaign. Arvista Gold trades on the TSXV under the symbol AVA and on the OTCQB under the symbol ARVSF. For more information on Arvista, please visit arvistagold.com.
Tri-Metals Mining is a growth-focused mineral exploration company exploring and developing its near-surface Gold Springs gold-silver project in mining-friendly Nevada and Utah. Tri-Metals has only drilled less than 10% of the gold targets at Gold Springs, and it already has a gold resource with a robust preliminary economic assessment. Tri-Metals believes that with further drilling, there is a significant potential to discover 3 to 5 million ounces of gold at Gold Springs. Tri-Metals shares are listed on the OTCQX and the TSX under symbols TMIAF and TMI respectively, and its website is trimetalsmining.com.